All right, this is Chuck Gregory, and right now I'm going to be playing for you something I recorded earlier tonight right here at the Jackson Mott Clark Family Reunion, and here we go.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back. Just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. And the song's called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why Arlo Guthrie called the song Alice's Restaurant. Now, it all started 156 Thanksgivings ago, 156 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my family got together in Muncie, Indiana, to celebrate, led by Civil War soldier William Nelson Jackson, and the Jackson Mott Clark clan hasn't missed a single year since that first reunion in 1862. What until the next year, Abraham Lincoln declared it to be an national holiday. So, you could say we got in right at the start. This year, we're hosted by Sandra and Jim Napolitan. Sandy is now the matriarch of the clan, and she's in that position for a long, long time. We're at their home, known as the Pagoda House, and designed by John Lloyd Wright, who's he's also famous for inventing Lincoln Logs. And his father Frank was pretty well known too. We had something like six turkeys this year, along with all the usual things go with and stuff, and casserole, potatoes, sweet potatoes, and scallops. They're a family tradition too. Like the reunion, so I feel about as stuffed as turkey would then, but
I'm thirsty.
But I didn't come here to talk about Thanksgiving or being stuffed or scallops oysters. I came here to talk about the New American Dream radio show, and my show, I do that every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 7 to 9 p.m. here in Long Beach, Indiana, in case I need to do a little mathematics challenge. And by the way, I'm recording this kid, and I'm going to be playing this back verbatim as the beginning of my actual show, which starts in a little while. So, many of you embarrass yourself. Well, hey, great. You can hear about it later on when I put the archives out. The New American Dream Radio Show was the concept of my friend and co-host Mike Talisek, an American writer. I got to meet Mike in person last year when I went up for the Duluth reunion. And also met some other people, and then this year I met more of them. And one of the interesting things that happened this year, I was looking through this collection at the fall of one of my radio shows, the Fantasy Radio. We thought we just spent a little while there, but turned after we got done signing in and swearing in and swearing we would destroy any of the material or put it back in the wrong box or even make too much noise, you know. We got to take three boxes over to the table and start looking. We're looking at writing from 1998 and 1978 and 2012 and all kinds of other dates, and there probably wasn't a single year, maybe even a single month, didn't have some kind of reference. There were cartoons and drawings too. Just about anything you can imagine being stuck into a library so you can look at it now. Partway along, I figured out the numbering scheme and I realized they had a total of 29 boxes. And we couldn't even get through three. So, while we were looking that over, somebody came out of the back of the archives area and walked up to our table and said, "Excuse me, are you Chuck Gregory?" And I'm thinking, "Oh no. Oh, what do I do now? Who tracked me down? What sin was it? Finally caught up with me?" Well, I said, "Well, yeah, yes, I am." I don't know if I'm going to stick my hand up or the cuffs or what. Hey, Judge. Well, I'm Derek Potts. I recognize your voice because I had talked to Duke for Anthony one time on your radio show.
Thank you.
All right. That's why I do it. Somebody listens. Somebody actually listens. Not that they recognize my voice. That makes me feel pretty darn good. So, I'm really glad to be here at the JMC reunion. Thank you.
All right, well, I am Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you for joining us tonight, and we hope you'll be back next week and every week right here, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, and it is a listener-supported network, so please show them some support. Now, tonight, I'm kind of on my own on this show. Mike wrote a strip for me, but he bailed out on taking part in the show. He said he had some family thing. I've got a family thing, too, and I'm doing it right from here, but, well, that's all right. I really don't hold it against him. I really appreciate him fixing the script up for me, and I'm going to do the best I can on my own here. So tonight we welcome these special guests, Julius Alafmong, Karen Kitkowski, Michael Annis, Philip Ferrugio, and Frank Cordero. And so this Thursday evening, this Thanksgiving 2018, we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, in Port Orange, in Jackson, Virginia, in Des Moines, Iowa, in Yaoundé, Cameroon, Denver, Colorado, and wherever you are. Through tonight's show, we'll be featuring the story of Johnny Moon. Well, it's been another long week in Moon Rock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. We begin the story now of Johnny Moon, a young boy from Moon Rock Lake, as he goes to school on a Friday. It's not just any Friday. He goes to school on Friday, November 22nd, 1963. So full of hope and energy. He's going to change his life because he is inspired. He's going to do better. He's going to be a great person, a great American. He is going to the moon. He could do this. He had to do this. Johnny has walked to school this morning, attended daily mass with the rest of the school, had communion, got in trouble with Sister Mark, and is now walking over to Sister Mark's classroom to get yelled at. Dave, the janitor, says Johnny will be on TV for having dropped his 15 cents for bowling on the church floor and got caught crawling on his stomach in his blue snowsuit under the girls. Yeah, really, Dave says. There'll probably be TV cameras up there when you get there. President Kennedy's not going to like this. Makes him look bad. Catholics on their stomach in the mud on the church floor. Well, but... Johnny put his head down and pumped his arms, trying to take bigger steps in his giant heavy boots and sweating snowsuit, wool mittens, and corduroy cap. Dave hurried up next to him. Not really, Johnny. He squatted down, put his arm on Johnny's shoulder. It's okay. You'll be all right. Johnny took a deep breath and opened his eyes wide. Really? He took off again down the walk like the most determined blue-plaid snowball. Johnny passed the familiar gray-painted and repainted wooden door of the entrance to the old maroon brick part of the school and plowed ahead into the vanilla brick zone. He put one boot up on the slick cement and reached to grab one of the double glass door handles. He grabbed with both hands and leaned his behind out over the two cement steps. He stood on the steps and pushed his nose into the glass. He knocked lightly on the glass with his left hand mitten fist. The glass punched him in the face. He stepped back, grabbed his nose as a big kid, a fifth or even sixth grader, pulled on the handle and walked in. Johnny scooted inside just in front of the closing door and followed the big kid the first flight of gray cement steps with dips where a million kids had stepped. Some in trouble. Johnny stopped. In front of him spread a wide stairway with gray steps and a brown handrail leading up. He heard music. He looked down, saw he was melting, getting the floor all wet. Moved toward the music. Maybe it was fourth grade after mass music. This would all be over quickly. He stopped at the top, leaned over to here. He saw the gym door where he would go to get the milk when he was on morning duty in that fourth grade fantasy world that seemed so untenable now. The music came from the locker room where the seventh and eighth graders dressed for PE, but Johnny didn't know that. He just knew it as the home of Ism and Anthony and Earl, the Negroes, who played basketball for the junior college and helped coach him sometimes and do physical fitness. Johnny heard laughing, talking mixed with music. The Negroes in the Catholic school basement locker room always had white girls down there, Johnny knew, and they smelled bad. They were kind of like gorillas and monkeys and chimpanzees, and they were from faraway towns, and why didn't they just stay there? He didn't know why they wanted to hang around with girls. Hey, my man! Johnny startled, looked up, saw Ism towering above. Hi, coach. Johnny waved. The man squatted to put his face level with Johnny. What's up, Johnny? Mr. Moon, Johnny Moon. Johnny didn't say anything, amazed and aghast that even the Negro coach basketball players knew that everyone called him Johnny Moon because he once said he was going to go to the moon like President Kennedy said. He said he wanted to be the one to go, the first American on the moon. You lost, little man? Johnny nodded. He'd never been this close before to the black man who lived with a couple of friends in the school locker room because nobody in town would rent to him. The man had tight, curly hair, shiny stuff on it. It looked squeaky to Johnny. The man had big eyes, smelled like honey and black olives. I'm in trouble, Johnny admitted in a whimper. Then asked, where was Sister Mark's room? That way? The man took Johnny's cold, clenched fist that housed the coins into his large, strong hand, led him up the gray steps of the new school section that the parish had been able to build a couple of years ago as more and more Catholic families had moved to town. Johnny didn't know how he felt being led up the stairs and down the halls, holding the hand of the Negro coach, whether he was proud to be with his coach or embarrassed to be led by the hand past the big kids like some dumb little creep. Ism got Johnny as far as the fourth grade hallway and knelt on one knee next to Johnny. He didn't really look like the Negro on his sister Johnny Mathis album, more like the one on Wild Kingdom. Ism pointed like Sacagawea toward Sister Mark's classroom and nodded solemnly, like it was bad medicine or the witch's castle in the forest. And he could go no farther. He could go no farther. Our first guest of the evening is going to be, I think it's Julia Auerbaum, but give me just a second while I move. Okay. It is Julia Auerbaum, who joins us each week from Yaoundé, Cameroon. And I may have cut a little of his time off, but we're going to get as much of it as we can in right now, right here, on the New American Dream radio show. And
hello, Chuck. Hello, Mike. Good evening and greetings to our listeners. Paul Biya of Cameroon again has been sworn in as the president after a deeply contested elections that took place on the 9th of October this year. One thing we've noticed is that there's a constant trend in most post-colonial or sub-Saharan African states, characterized mostly by the way the elections are carried out. It is mostly highly contested. There is always a tendency to believe that the incumbent, especially in regimes or in states where presidential mandates are not limited, there's always this tendency for people to believe that incumbents don't want to quit power. They do everything possible to stay in power. They organize elections as though they are trying to please the international community. They are trying to please or to make believe that they are Democrat and that they are in a democracy. I'm sorry if there's a lot of noise around here. Actually, I'm out of Yaoundé. I'm in Douala, where I'm doing research for my work. That's why it's difficult to find a quiet environment to do the recording. But I think this one will help us. So he was sworn in last week and amidst all the contestations from the opposition parties, because we've had opposition party leaders who believed or who said that they won these elections and that the regime in place, or Paul Biya's regime, or the regime of the incumbent, rigged it in his favor. So protests were staged, people were caught and locked up, beaten. In the end, Paul Biya was sworn in, and he is the president now ruling the country. Despite all this, we've had the Anglophone crisis that have been on the rise. More casualties have been registered in the Anglophone regions. So many civilians have been killed. Those who are fighting for secession, though the armed movement fighting for secession, most of them have been killed. And even the government forces, which those on the other side, that is the Anglophone militia, call it terrorists, have also been killed. And it's like a game where in the family, people are killing one another simply because they don't want others to go away. They don't want separation. But the question that keeps on coming up is, but what's wrong in people separating? What's wrong in letting people who don't want to be with you go away? Why will people be killed just to preserve the territory? It is not that we are in a situation where some foreign forces, some exogenous forces, are trying to come to take our land. We are in a situation where a minority is fighting for what we call the right to self-determination. That is a right recognized by the United Nations, a right that has been put in place due to the conflict or the plea or the quarrels or the problems that minority groups in the world go through. Yes, they have been given right to self-determination, but why would people be killed in order for a territory to be preserved? We now understand that the fight for unity, the fight to keep the state in place, is not a fight for the love of the people. It's a fight for love of the territory. It's a fight for love for the natural resources that are found in this territory. So that's why people are killed, not in the name of loving or keeping the country, but they are killed in the name of preserving the land, so that resources will be exploited. But this is common of most autocratic regimes. Common because in a situation where somebody has been in power for over 36 years, like in Cameroon, and who doesn't want to leave power? Who has built or put in place so many networks to the point where these networks are working in his favor, to him to constantly or to stay in power forever till he dies? We begin to ask a lot of questions. And as I was going through some thoughts 2 weeks ago, when President Pobia was being sworn in, I heard some elites, I mean some elderly people say, calling him the father of the nation. That Pobia is like a father. Pobia is a father who loves this nation. And I thought of theorizing on the notion of a father in politics. When a president is given the figure of a father, how does it impact democracy? How does it impact change? How does it impact elections? Who is a father? A father, first of all, I've started by theorizing a father. A father is someone who is natural. A father is not bought in the market. A father doesn't go out for campaign to become a father. A father doesn't need to be rich to be your father. A father doesn't need to be poor to be your father. A father is just a natural thing. And we don't change fathers. In the African context, it will be surprising for some of us to know, the word uncle does not exist. Your uncle is called Pa, is your father. You call your uncle father. And you call any other person who has or who can have the age of your father or your grandfather, you call them father or grandfather, mother or grandmother. There's no auntie and there's no uncle in the Africa, in the traditional African nomenclature of how people are being called. So when you start from that point, you discover that when people...
Unfortunately, that's all that we're going to have time for tonight from Julius. And it was a very intriguing presentation. So we'll try to get it up on the website by itself so you can listen to the whole thing. Thank you, and talk to you on the other side of the station break.
At Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Willow's World, Studio A. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry.
She travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract, stream of consciousness malapropisms. She weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners, or chatters, are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host. Represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host, Radio Station. Represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100%.
Well, folks, here in the studio, I'm getting some kind of a weird echo effect, but I do hope that it's not going out on the air that way, and we will just plug right on and assume that everything is going to be okay. So give me just a minute to get my script back where it was supposed to be. Hang on here. All right, our next guest of the evening is Philip Ferrugio. Phil joins us each week from Port Orange, Florida. And the title of his column is, It's the Empire, Stupid. All right, and we're just about to pull that up right now. Here we go.
Good evening, Working Snips, and happy Thanksgiving. Upside Down Mark Twain. Mark Twain, also known as Samuel Clemens, 1835 to 1910, best known for his literary works like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, was also a man with deep-rooted empathy for the underclass containing people of color. Few readers of his works realize that he was also a staunch opponent of imperialism, having been president of the Anti-Imperialist League from 1901 until his death in 1910. Twain wrote about the treatment of the Chinese in San Francisco during the Civil War when he was a newspaper reporter there. In 1865, he astonished many passers-by, even those who fought for the abolition of slavery years earlier, when he chose to walk arm-in-arm through the San Francisco streets with the editor of the recently established Afro-American newspaper, The Elevator. Of course, one of his most famous quotes was on his definition of politics, to protect us from the crooks and scoundrels. He also said something that resonates so strongly today. Sometimes I wonder whether the world is being run by smart people who are putting us on or by imbeciles who really believe it. You know, we just had a midterm election that broke the record for both voter turnout and also money spent, a real conundrum to say the least. The two-party, one-party food fight did have one added caveat, something that got this writer to actually do something I never do, and that was to vote across the board in my state of Florida for all Democrats. Why? Well, as Bob Dylan sang so profoundly, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Sadly, the wind has been one filled with fascist and even neo-Nazi elements, with such an exclamation point right here in the Sunshine State. One guy, the sitting governor, has such a tainted past as a businessman that many felt he should have been more easily been indicted than even be running for office years ago. The other guy, a congressman running for governor, had an electoral machine behind him with intentions of getting him from the governor's mansion to the White House in 2024. Running against an Afro-American mayor of Tallahassee, his campaign supporters in infamous robocalls played what many would call jungle music, along with a voice that could be construed as that of a ghetto black man. Between that and the fear card of an evil caravan getting closer seemed to push some perhaps who maybe would have sat this one out to get off their asses and go and vote. After all, those good and decent taxpaying Floridians need to be protected from the diabolical black and brown undesirables. One could only imagine how Mark Twain would have reacted to all of the above and much more. That being the utter warmongering foreign policies of all of our recent presidents, including this latest tool of empire. Yes, Twain would have been out there front and center protesting our nation's illegal and immoral excursion into Panama, the Balkans, Iraq 1, Iraq 2, Afghanistan, Libya, and now Syria. Twain said it all on this quote of his. I have read carefully the Treaty of Paris between the United States and Spain, and I am seeing that we do not intend to free, but to subjugate the peoples of the Philippines. We have gone there to conquer, not to redeem, and so I am an anti-imperialist. I am opposed to having the ego put its talons on any other land. Though this writer did the unimaginable by my principles of casting votes for the Democrats this time around, never again. For they now control the House, and perhaps in 2020 the Senate, and even the White House. But what will that change on the issue that Mark Twain devoted his later years to? Imperialism. We know that even progressive Democrats like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and now Miss Ocasio-Cortez remain silent on A, the obscene military spending, B, 1,000 foreign bases worldwide, C, a destruction of Libya and aid to the jihadists in Syria, causing millions of refugees spilling into Europe and elsewhere, D, NATO's planned encirclement of Russia and the diversion by the Russian election tampering hoax, and E, Israel's continued fascist-like treatment of Palestinians. Thus, the only hope to finally see America with a K become America with a C is for tens, even hundreds of millions of working stiffs nationwide to realize that imperialist and ultra-militarist foreign policy bleeds our economy and destroys our nation's moral compass. Mark Twain knew that over 100 years ago. Why not us?
We resume the story of Johnny Moon. Johnny stuck his chin up, then down, and moved off slowly like a chunky ship from port, hugging the wall like one side of a little dog magnet set, as he headed toward Doom, Sister Mark's classroom. The fourth grade hall felt sophisticated and learned and quiet, like you didn't need to yell if you knew a lot. On the walls were historical handmade student depictions of the pilgrims beating the Indians on Thanksgiving, Moses in the burning bush, and Washington cutting down the cherry tree. Lockers made up one whole wall. Johnny scuffled along, kept one finger running down the wall for balance. He came to the giant vanilla wooden door with a window and looked kind of like the door to the medical clinic that Johnny feared, because it meant mystery, smell of alcohols, needles, fear, pain. The window etched into the glass, it said, Sister Mark, fourth grade. Johnny took a giant, deep breath. He looked back down the quiet hall, saw that he was all alone, and thought that maybe Sister Mark and the fourth graders and the TV cameras weren't back from Mass yet. Well, he'd been here. That's what he would tell Sister M&M, Sister Mary Michael. He went there. They weren't there, but he went there. Oh, well, I guess it's over now. He was there. They weren't even there yet. Well, he really would have liked to have visited with them to gain the advantage of their experiences as to how he could improve his deportment, but his toes felt sweaty and squishy inside his boots. His underwear just turned all around. Well, he breathed again and stepped up to the door. He tapped lightly with his gray mitten fist so that even he couldn't hardly tell he was knocking. He scanned up and down the hall. Relief burned in his heart. He wasn't that good, but he wasn't that bad. And now he would live, so he'd make every reasonable effort to maybe do a little better. The door pushed open, like the giant inside had exhaled, causing Johnny to dodge out of its way with an exaggerated step, like jumping a mud puddle. Sister Mark filled the doorway, like a forest nun that Johnny had awakened. Her arms were crossed. She scowled, looking down at the notorious church-crawling little criminal kid from the third-grade classroom in the old section. He thought of his own warm, bright room and Sister Mary Michael's smiling face, and then in an instant was yanked back by Sister Mark's stamping of her severe, worn black shoes on the tile floor. Sister Mark pointed down at a line, a white piece of tape on the linoleum. Johnny stepped up, put his grungy booted toes on the line, just short of the line, not daring to touch the line. Johnny Moon looked up, and there was the whole fourth grade, rows and rows of them with their hands folded, teeth glowing, eyes reflecting the light from the giant glow in the iridescent plastic Jesus on the wall. In the shadows of the fourth grade cave, they grinned ironically as if they were waiting to rule on whether they should allow Johnny's loan application to go through on his sharecropper farm. They stared at him like Johnny had killed God, sitting there in their connected rows like sleighs, toboggans they'd taken to mass and had landed back here dry in perfect rows. Johnny's heart pounded, and well, he hoped he would not pee his snowsuit as he had wet the floor of the kindergarten class all those years ago. "What do you have to say for yourself, young man?" Sister glared down at Johnny like the hardest nun on Mount Rushmore. He looked for a moment into the stone faces of the 1,000,000 fourth graders, the girls in blue plaid dresses and white blouses, the boys in dress clothes, then to the back and to the front, to Sister's desk with a small statue of a saint and a box of Kleenex and a prisoner matchbox, red and white Chevy. He looked up at Sister and down, tried to move his toes enough to see him through the rubber boots, wondering if he might lose circulation and maybe have to have his toes cut off. Maybe his feet needed to freeze. They'd been in there a long time. His stomach began to hurt. Maybe it hurt before. He was just now noticing it. He felt lightheaded, warm. He started to worry about appendicitis. His lips begged permission to quiver. His teeth wished to rattle like a skeleton, but Johnny refused. His knees asked to be able to crumble to the floor, and he told him no. The room sat quiet for hours and hours, like the whole weekend in a storage locker at the meatpacking plant. We'll continue with Johnny Moon a little bit later, but right now, we are going to call Karen Gutowski, one of our monthly guests who always has some great things to say, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what she has for us on this Thanksgiving. So here we go. We're going to add her onto the call just about as quick as we can do it. Okay, here we go. Hello, Karen?
Oh, yes, hey.
Oh, I didn't hear you say, well, hello, happy Thanksgiving, and welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm on my own tonight, so I'm going a little crazy trying to do everything at once. But,
it sounds like me this morning for Thanksgiving, yeah, like a lot of people, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right. Well, welcome to the show. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, same to you. Same to you. No, it's great. Yeah, Thanksgiving. I think I always have the fourth Thursday, so it seems like I've had the Thanksgiving now for a while, where I can talk about stuff. And, you know, it's an important time to reflect and all that, in which we do. But, you know, I know a lot of people, when they get together with family members, there's a lot of discussion, and some of it's political, which, of course, you're supposed to avoid for your digestive system, but I'm sure people don't. And I actually had no political discussions to speak of, or if I had them, they were with people who, you know, there was not a disagreement, per se. The perspectives were the same. But the week before Thanksgiving, my brother came down, and he is a, my brother is close in age to me. He has converted or transitioned, I don't know, into a, I guess you'd say a social democrat or a democratic socialist, which is, I'm not sure if that term means what people who call themselves that think it means, but that's kind of what he considers himself. And he's motivated and values the things that I think a lot of people do, equality, you know, fairness, justice, resource allocations that make sense, you know, the same people that I rail against sometimes on this program and elsewhere, you know, the elites, the corporate capitalists that kind of run our country, the banksters, these people are, my socialist brother, of course, rails against them as well. We find a common target of our feelings of powerlessness vis-a-vis the state, and of course that makes me an anarcho-capitalist, and it makes him a democratic socialist, or perhaps a Marxist. I mean, he would happily claim that title, which is that, and that's very interesting. That's very interesting that we share the same concerns, identify many of the same problems, blame the same sectors of government and society for most of those problems. Obviously, I think there's blame to go around in all parts, and he would admit that. But our solutions are very different. And one of the things, of course, I think that maybe separates people like me, who are simply anti-state, pro-freedom, and people who are the more Marxist or democratic socialist leaning, is our solutions are very different. And it doesn't mean that either one of them are appropriate. It doesn't mean either one of them are even workable. But I know the folks that are anti-state, like myself, don't find any solution in the state, because the state implies force, and force implies violence. In fact, the use of force when the state is doing it, and actually when anyone is doing it, I mean, it implies violence. I mean, I work with horses. You know, if you want to force a horse to do something, or any animal, you do so by either inducing fear or implementing pain. I mean, I'm sorry, that's force. It is pain, it is fear, it is violence. You know, there's ways to train animals without those things. But commonly, force implies fear and violence. And so the state uses force. It's the only tool. I mean, the state actually has a monopoly, you know, on force. That's kind of the definition of the state. And so its tools are the very things that my brother, the socialist, rails against, you know, fear and violence. And of course, along with that, injustice and unfairness. So, So I say, well, you know, the solution can't be the state. And I think part of the problem for a lot of leftists, a lot of socialists and Marxists and democratic socialists and whatever they call themselves, which my brother is one proudly and openly, and he campaigns and he's an activist in that sense. I mean, he marches and he does lots of things like that. He doesn't see the state as being a negative thing. He feels that the state should use the force, it should use its power, but it should do so for good and for fairness and for human justice, not just simple justice like in a court of law justice, but to make things right, okay? And it should use its power, it should retain its power, it should have the power, and it should simply use it for the right things. And so I think that's the difference. So it's not left and right, it's authoritarian versus anti-authoritarian. It's the state versus the anti-state. And but it's good to know that that we identify many of the same problems. We disagree on the solutions. And so I was talking to my friends at Thanksgiving because I had both relatives and some friends over, which is pretty traditional for so many people. And talking to them about medical issues, because I have my friends who came over, both over 70. My father-in-law is in the hospital, 82, cancer. He's not well enough to treat the cancer, so, you know, he's getting good medical care, but the prognosis is bad. And so, you know, people talk about their health, and they talk about their medical care and their choices and lack of choices, however the case may be, the cost, the benefits. And these folks are on government health care, government-provided health care, in the sense of being on Medicare and Social Security age folks. And we're talking about choice, and we're talking about prices. And, of course, a number of them were talking about people they knew who, you know, shopped around for their health care by flying or driving to Mexico to get it. One story was shared about a kid who needed an appendectomy, and it was on a holiday weekend. Kid needed an appendectomy on Friday, and kind of an urgent thing. And it was, I don't know, the price, 12 or so thousand, and 2,000 if he drove to Mexico, and they would take care of the job as soon as he got there on Saturday morning. So that's what they did, and the medical care was good. And they talked also, my friends who are very conservative friends, talked about how we don't understand, we Americans, and this is again an area we agree with our socialist friends, that Americans don't understand Hispanic immigration in this country. They don't understand Mexico at all, and we don't see it for what it really is, which is a great neighbor in so many ways. And one of them is, of course, how developed it is. And one guy, one of the persons at the table said, "There's as many computer code writers and people that work with high tech in Mexico City as there are in Palo Alto." So that's an interesting thing. We never hear that. And so I think that's something my brother, the socialist who lives in Texas and is for, letting all of our lesser advantaged friends from the South who want to come, great. We should recognize that these people should be, I think, welcome. And so maybe I don't sound like a conservative, but I'm certainly anti-state, because these borders and these rules are state products, and they are enforced through the use of force, which I oppose. So anyway, I share this a little bit just to show that not only do we have a lot of the same assessment of the problem, we have the same goals, disagree on where the force, where the motivation, and where the power should be. Certainly, you know, as an anarcho-capitalist, the power should be with the individual, the family, and out from that point, broader and broader networks. An authoritarian, and unfortunately, many socialists believe the power should be in the state, and that the state will responsibly take care of all the people that are part of that state. And, you know, I don't think the evidence bears it out, but we'll see how it goes, and if we experiment. Another thing we talked about briefly was the power of pricing, and of course that story about the appendectomy and a lot of the other medical services that you can order and pay for a la carte. In fact, even India, not just Mexico that you can get to closely, but you know, the price of airfare to India oftentimes is nothing compared to the total cost of that same healthcare in the United States. And so people, if they are aware of the pricing and the availability of product, will make choices that benefit them and their families. And if you control prices, and we talked about this typical lesson of price control, if you go into a grocery store and you see that they have Snickers bars, giant Snickers bars, which sell for $1.50 for 5 cents each, the question is, how long do you think the supply of Snickers bars at 5 cents each will will remain in that store. And the question is about, you know, three people into the checkout, they will be purchased up, snapped up, they'll be gone for various reasons. Some people just like them for 5 cents and they want to save them. Other people will see an opportunity to resell. But it's a deal you can't pass up because it is irrational. It's an irrational pricing. That they're worth more than that to people who shop at that store, no doubt. So if you mandate low prices or no prices, because my brother the socialist says healthcare is right and it should be free, but if you take away and eliminate the communication tool, which is pricing, you take away people's choice. You warp the market. And ultimately, there isn't any of that super low-cost, super good deal. There's no really good fresh Snickers bars available at 5 cents. And if you price them at 5 cents, soon there will be none at 5 cents. I mean, the market just doesn't bear that. But if things are priced according to how they're valued, people make judgments. We don't have free market in healthcare today, so it's unfair, I think, to talk about a free market healthcare system. We don't have one in this country, haven't had one for some time. It's certainly not run by like a free market. But it's also unfair to say, but we need to socialize it and we need to make it free. And it's a right and the government should provide it. Because there's only one way government provides anything, which is, of course, through its monopoly on force. And that I don't like. And so, you know, we had the pardoning of the turkeys, I think, what they call peas and carrots. The president traditionally pardons those poor turkeys and gives them a reprieve, and they live at the turkey farm for the rest of their natural life. Yeah, that's great. It's kind. It's good. A free market in healthcare is also kind and good. People live in that if you really have it. So, but anyway, again, I point out the commonalities. We have so many with those we might disagree with politically. But I think many times we identify the same problem, and we want the same thing.
I think you're exactly right, Karen, and we're out of time, but... Thank you so much. I'm really glad that you're on the Thanksgiving show every year because you always give us something to think about. And, hey.
Thank you, and I'm grateful to be here. And,
hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship. Or be quiet. Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship. You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth. You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
Ohio Wexel Politics will be on from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A. Mark Schneider will have guests on that will discuss many important topics, including the state of the world today. However, much of the show will be dedicated to the writings of Edward Albert Meyer. Let me read a short passage from one of his writings. Love is the highest principle of creation, and through it, everything exists in absolute logic. All of nature in its indescribable splendor is nothing but the love of creation, which is expressed visibly. The love of creation is everywhere, because without it, nothing at all would be able to exist. Please join Mark on Ohio Exopolitics from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the evening is Michael Annis. Michael joins us each month from Denver, and we're going to add him to the show right about now. Michael's a poet, a publisher, and just a really interesting guy. And here we go.
Hello.
Well, hello, Michael. It's Chuck, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air, and happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Hi, Chuck. Hi, Mike. It's good to be back on the New American Dream. With that said, I wish you and all New American Dream listeners a memorable Thanksgiving. Tonight I'm going to read or perform part two of my meditation, Ab initio, Ab initio, which from the Latin translates as in the beginning, from the beginning. It deals with the voluntary and involuntary migration of human beings. Likewise, the transmigration of souls through centuries and millennia. I'm dedicating tonight's reading to those victims of the California wildfires, particularly those who still remain unaccounted for, and those who did lose their lives. I'm also dedicating this tonight to my father, Roy, and my dear friend and poet, Molly Bernstein, or Molly Pop, as I called her affectionately, both who are forever seared together in my consciousness, who on the same November day in 2016 that I performed the funeral for my deceased father, my friend Molly Pop died unexpectedly. I had been mentoring her in poetics and literature. With all that in mind, I begin by saying that I believe all language to be coded language. It's simply a matter of degree. Ab initio, ab initio, part two. Language is myth and superstition, seeking to control and manipulate destiny. To create heaven out of words, the word man is a myth unto himself. To where was lost the remembrance of I am in the flesh and blood of thought? Oh, where shall I have gone, the rivers of my blood pouring out through the centuries? I think, therefore I am, ergo I remember thinking, therefore I remember being. I am. I am a nation of one. My heartbeat envelops continents, forms passages through space and time. I am my own
great-grandchild. I am my own former practices and beliefs, and in a distant future, I will inherit every sin, every goodness that I leave behind now. Peering through windows of psychic regression, old Moloch sneers at the small bodies cast upon his altar as he gobbles them down. Children of Africa, children of India's slums, dead bodies of infants from the ghetto prison of Palestine. Staring through windows of psychic aggression, the dance macabre delights the cancerous corporate crust of unpunished murder and pillage, stealing across the bodies of the old and destitute, smearing into unrecognizable masses of suffering the beautiful faces of the future, the beautiful faces of the world's children. Chained to the infrastructure of habit, the word that is language is held in each cell of each body, appearing and disappearing through the chains of psychic time. Surrealistic chain, the chain that stitches nothing, that stretches across nothing, chaining nothing to nothing's chain. The myth of Jacob's ladder chaining the earth to earth's heaven, where nothing rules nothing, as everything stitches chains, angels ascending and descending along the axis of insanity, where balances reality against mythos. The absolute is the process of its own becoming. It becomes concrete or actual by its own development. Hegel. Where in the process is knowing, and where in the process is envisioning? Can one envision without seeing that which already exists, as that which is perfect already exists, has existed and shall exist? Are they not two sides of the same quantum point, existing simultaneously, never ceasing, mutually vibratory through one another's existence? All things possible exist, scrawled on a restroom wall above the urinal. Infinite rhizomes, spirals, latticework, and root systems, fingers, arms, legs entwine in naked dying, whirling pools of ego saturants whose despair is the child of disconnect from destiny and purpose, at the mercy of churn and flow. Infinite regression in a psychic system, circumjacent to a unified theory of the human soul. In the evolving autobiography of psychic anarchy, each womb is a black hole expelling dead suns. Does all existence narrow itself down at the far horizon to a Nazi death camp, where images of suffering agony become non-compliant eternities, and the iron gate becomes the paradox of freedom? Where nests of being transfigure through unraveling their psychic core, alien to determinism, estranged from free will, hounded by external forces that seek to dominate and oppress them into background, foreground, ground up. Were the bodies of Auschwitz-Buchenwald named a nest for Jewish liberation from Old Testament, from New Testament, to the anti-testament of superstition and universal fantasy, where reincarnates chose to loose themselves en masse from bad karma by watching their children slaughtered, to cover the heavens in clouds of smoke, the children loosing themselves from bad karma by choosing to come into the world in time for chimneys through which they ascended once again from death camps to soul guides in the great, bleak, and ugly beyond. Christ, progenitor of Homo Christos, penetrator of intelligent infinity, died, then rose again, giving the eternal message. The stones cry out their disinheritance, for the temple is neither stone nor brick. The temple is within, and each human body is the Holy of Holies, its spiritual body undefiled, the temporal body crucified, the crows feasting upon our histories, devouring our psychic eyes, the temporal and sacrificial language of human space-time coalesces, seeking its own immortality. Human DNA chain rolls out to create a space-time universe. Bodies housing minds form the interstellar clouds and nebulae giving birth to the stars. Human bodies intercourse as interlocutor through rubbing bodies together. Fire igniting through insurrection in transcendent incandescence. Tectonic plates shearing apart, forming continents of human greed, strife, grief, and misery, reinforced and propagated by the gods of vicious religions, psychic slums collapsing into mountains of dead humanimals, wingless birds, horned gods, gold, guns, cash, and gash, cigar-chawing carnies barking come-ons through the looking glass of psychic damnation, shouting enticement out of a horse's ass. Ladies and gentlemen, step right up. Love and rockets, lust and riches, and a hanging today for everyone at high noon. Two-headed creation myths joined at the hips of grief, strangled dangling by their horns and beards from the light poles, trestles, and oak trees, erections purple and throbbing, suspended under the flagpole and motto of eternity. I am who am. Squirming and kicking their legs, trying futilely to free themselves from dead human brains that await their resurrection through a final gushing ejaculation where pleasure seeks to overcome terror and fantasy and agony.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Chuck.
Really appreciate having you on the show every month, and hey, thanks especially for being with us on Thanksgiving night, and hey, talk to you next month, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. Occupy Dealey Plaza. That's where it all began. November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m., 55 years ago this year, today. Fill Dealey Plaza with protesters and signs and singing and speaking, and let them bring their dogs and their cops and their robbers and murderers, their sniper rifles, double secret video cameras, microphones. Occupy Dealey Plaza. We demand a truth commission to replace the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission. We want freedom. We want peace. We want real hope and real change. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let them know we know what they have done. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let the world know this is America. The next guest of the evening is Frank Cordero. Frank joins us each week from the Des Moines Catholic Worker House, and we're very lucky to have him. And I'm going to pull up the conversation that I had with him in just a moment. And as the computer cooperates. All right, here we go. Quiet. I'm going to do an interview.
Yo.
Hi,
Pete. Hey, Chuck. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I just finishing a Thanksgiving day. The weather was really nice, and I went to my family. Some of the community members had something going on here. We do not open on Thanksgiving Day, even though Thursday is a day we are normally open.
Huh.
We decided a number of years ago to throw in the towel and trying to compete with better people that are serving better meals. You can get a meal in this neighborhood quite easily on Thanksgiving Day. So it's our time to rest. That's one thing we've done. That's an interesting thing. We did, though, every year in the last 20, I'm sure, there's an area grade school, Moulton School, and they do a food collection for us. So we go down and pick it up. And this year, I haven't been there for quite some time, but this year I went down to give the 2-minute, like, you know, thank you very much scene.
Yeah.
And this school is just a remarkable school. It's filled with anybody but anybody who's not white. We got blacks, you got people from Africa, you got people from Asia, India. It's just amazing, a little neighborhood school that has lots of cultural diversity. So I got up there and I said to the kids, I said, you know, I've been on 3 different continents in the last 2 years, and everywhere I go, kids, you guys' age look at me and they call me Santa Claus. And I said, you know, if I were Santa Claus, this room would be filled with the children of the world, and that as an American, I want you to know that I'm thankful that you are here. Because I am confident that the country is going to be much better with folks like you.
Hmm.
And then I went on to say about Thanksgiving being, you know, about a time when folks who, in this country, it's our best national holiday, even though I like Christmas and all. But as a holiday, everybody, every religion has a mandate to be thankful and to be giving. In fact, the day you combine the name, Thanksgiving is the complete act of hospitality. And I told the kids, we get to do that every day when we're open. Mm. And they get to help us. I just thought that was something I would share about kind of the unique kind of relationship we have in our community, in our local scene here. Little marker. After my brother Joe, who's been a principal at a Catholic school for the last plus 30 years, retired, and now he's volunteering a couple hours a week. And last week we went out for a drink after the Tuesday shift, and we ran into a city council person. What was interesting is that he brought up one of the local issues people have about us and how much that many people in the city are very respectful for who we are and what we do. Mm-hmm. We've earned a kind of some kind of a rep for folks who are really in the neighborhood doing hands-on stuff. So that felt good too. So it's a day and a season of thankfulness. I told a couple thank you stories, mostly when I wrote my letter last year, my beg letter for the Catholic Worker, and what I hoped would happen in the year 2018.
Ah.
I remember being in this situation. Jess had left and Ruby had left, and I had no idea if I'd ever see them or if they'd ever come back.
Right.
And I just hoped that 2018, that Jess and Ruby would come back and that we'd have another chance to support them. And as difficult as the times are, And as difficult as it is, this is exactly what has happened at the end of this year. I'm getting another chance, and our community is getting another chance to support these women and others. So it's just a difficult time. But I'm reminded of the term crisis. Crisis in the East means opportunity. And so there's a lot of things going on, lots of moving parts here at the Catholic Worker in Des Moines. The least of them not being myself. I need to figure out a way. I'm at 67 to get myself out of the center of this thing and get on the peripheral of the community efforts so that others can pick up and maintain the scene here. So my challenge will be trying to get out of the way, which is always a difficult thing for me. I hope I can do it. My hope this year as we enter into a new year coming up. Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, thank you so much, Frank. And, God bless you all there. And happy Thanksgiving.
Have a good one, too, brother. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now we return to the story of Johnny Moon. Johnny has just gone in where he was expecting to be reprimanded by Sister Mark, but ended up having the whole class in front of him. Johnny saw the framed photos of the President and General Washington, the detailed graph on the blackboard behind Sister's desk of how the world was made in 7 days and what was created on each day. Didn't seem as though anyone was ever going to talk, and soon they'd have to listen to the morning announcements and morning prayers of the new intercom box, so Johnny just waited. He smelled gum, cherry, wild, stolen. He followed the aroma to a boy in one of the front row seats. The boy stopped chewing upon making eye contact and looked at Sister. "What should be done with him?" Sister asked the class, like Poncho Pilate. "Is there anything wrong with crawling upon the floor on your stomach like a grasshopper in church before Max?" A few unseen girls tittered. The boy had been chewing, raised his hand, and stood by his desk in one motion. "It helps a communist," he said. "This boy might be a communist. He probably is. And the devil benefits by his actions." He sat down. Johnny could see him shove his gum deeper into the side of his mouth like a butthead gopher. A front desk girl with glasses and a watch stood by her desk without raising her hand. Johnny could only hope her testimony would be disallowed. "The president would not like it," she said, "because the Kennedy family is all Catholics and he never laughed in church or did anything like that. He was captain of his own boat." She sat. Johnny looked down, saw a puddle around his boots, disrespecting the white tape line. He scooted back and took inventory to determine that it was only slush water. "Was it a sin?" Sister flicked her headpiece with a toss of her head as if she and Johnny and the fourth grade class were filming a Breck hair commercial. She pulled magically a handkerchief from nowhere to wipe her flaming red nose. "If a truck hit Jonathan," she began. "Or a train," one of the children offered. "Or a train," said Sister. "Hit Mr. Moon today." "Or if a building fell on him," somebody chose to add. "We'll just stick with the truck and train for now." Johnny shook his head subtly to sneak Sister the information that wasn't his real name. "Would he be in a state of sin and suffer the eternal fires of hell?" She finished wiping her nose and somehow disposed of the handkerchief without pockets. Through the open closet door, Johnny saw a big brown box of brown paper towels, a mop, extra long erasers, and a Nixon poster. "He's fat." The sounds, like jabbing a scissors into a balloon came from one of the invisible girl gigglers. "We're supposed to get in shape," said the gum-chewing boy, "to fight communism. Go to the moon." "The moon," someone said. Someone else laughed. The boy looked back to see who was laughing. Sister turned to Johnny and stepped toward him. "Just why do you walk?" She twisted and ground her heels into the floor and raised her toes up together like Dorothy. "Why do you walk to school in November of the year while your siblings and all the other children ride to school with their parents at the same time in the morning and always arrive to mass on time?" Her jaw showed through her skin. "Why? It's cold out there." She stared, rubbed her sore nose with the back of her hand. "Amazing," she whispered and shook her head. Johnny looked at her, then at the class, then down at the lake he was making. "It was my first day," he thought, denied a request from his eyes to become wet. "A strong boy," he began. "Please raise your head and speak to the class, not to the floor, young man." "A strong boy makes a strong man, makes a strong nation, country." Many of the girls snickered. The gum-chewer chipmunk and two boys near him who looked like they could be twins laughed out loud. "And yet," Sister stepped in front of Johnny and turned her back to him to address her class like a prosecutor before a jury. "And yet you deem to crawl on your stomach in... Are we to know if your snow attire was filthy when you put it on this morning? On the floor under the pews of church,
just prior
to the onset of the holy saying of the Mass of our Lord? Just to get money," Gumshoe growled. "Would Jesus be on the floor grubbing for money in the dirt and mud?"
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry.
Money.
At Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist, featuring Willow Andreasen, your host.
Join Willow,
Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
"Polling," she said, as if saying poopsicle. We'll continue on the other side of the station break.
Alert, listen up now.
Tune into Crypto Corner with Crypto
0xE05173.
We talk about decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern, Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
We continue the story of Johnny Moon. When we left, Sister had just discovered that the reason Johnny needed the money that he was crawling on the floor for during Mass was because it was his bowling money. or swirled to Johnny in the dock. Is that so? Johnny touched eyes with Sister Mark and nodded slowly. Bowling, she said, as if saying poopsicle. She returned to her class and began to pace. For the President's Council on Physical Fitness, I assume? Johnny shrugged and nodded quickly when she turned on him again. Bowling's not a sport anyway, a boy in the second row stood to recite and sat. Johnny watched Sister until she looked at him and then nodded. Yes, it is. Coach Ism takes us, he says. Sister turned sideways, half facing Johnny and half her very own class. It was probable she had decided she was prepared to pass sentence. She produced a giant navy blue jar of Noxema, took out a dab, and painfully touched her nose. Johnny looked away for one moment to follow a sound of a pen being clicked like a gun cocked, and the jar disappeared. His eyes began to burn. Sister rubbed her chin, found a pimple, and began fondling it. The third grade will not be going bowling this week, she declared. But Sister Mary, Johnny blurted. I will speak to Sister Michael Mary, she said. The money will instead be given to the missions. She walked toward Johnny as a gunslinger in the street, certain his foe has no gun. Where is your money? Johnny held up his sweaty gray mitten fist as high as his nose and opening his hand revealed the dime and pennies like the blackjack and ace. Sister leaned herself into a C as a blue jay or a robin's nest. You only have 14 cents, she said. You weren't going bowling anyway. You may return to your room, she said, as a titter fever spread through. Johnny took one blind step backward as the door slammed, leaving him alone in the hall with the burning bush, the cherry tree, and an unseen dripping faucet. He turned and trudged down the fourth grade hall like a Russian soldier headed home across a million miles of taiga, wondering how he could ever find his own room. It wasn't on this floor. Maybe if he just kept going. He kept going, walking slower and slower as he grew more confused, like Jesus wandering in the desert smelling water, like a cowboy sniffing the log fires of home. He followed the aroma of brown paper towels and dispenser soap. Later, Johnny Moon is lining up to go outside for recess. Jane Lincoln Frogs kind of snuggles up next to him by the blackboard, gives him a glove she found on the floor that wasn't his, and he was going to make it fit if he had to break his own hand. Maybe you should go to the moon, Johnny, she smiled. You really should. Are you going to? Yes, yes, I'm going to. Johnny took the damp glove and forced it on, felt his face glow and throb. I'd like to. Then you should just do it. I would. Hey, you're up. Someone hollered at Johnny, sitting on the ground against the priest's garage while the rest of his team took their turns kicking. Sister Mark served as permanent pitcher for both teams today. Sister M&M stayed with the kids in the merry-go-round monkey bar swings area. They supposedly rotated, but Mark most often grabbed the kickball game. Mark's cheeks gleamed rosy red, framing a wide smile. She tied her black shawl around her waist, and her black gloves were cut off at the knuckles. She pounded the white ball in her hands. Johnny continued to play in the dirt, messing with the ants, naming them, watching what they did, where they went, who they associated with. While he doodled in the dirt with a stick, making pictures of space alien ships, my favorite Martian, little antennas and laser beams, and Moses in the burning bushes. Johnny, imagine being one of those ants down there working hard, finding this one twig like it was the golden twig, the twig of all time, pulling that twig around all day long, thinking there must be something special to be done with this amazing twig, and just looking and looking and nobody telling him nothing. "Who is up?" Sister hollered out, breast puffs hanging in the air above her head like cartoon dialogue boxes. "Who's up? Let's go!" She pointed at Johnny with his behind turned toward her on his knees with both hands on the bricks, pushing and grabbing the sand, trying to whistle the intro music to the Andy Griffith Show. Johnny found his way up, shuffled up to take his turn at bat. He stepped up to the rubber mat home plate on the blacktop, and then backed up three long steps. "Come on," someone yelled. "Why'd he always have to do that? He just stands against the door? Jeez." Johnny pressed his heels against the white garage door. Sister leaned over and wrapped the ball in her left hand and arm. She shuffled and slid like a bowler. At the end of her release, she flicked her wrist. The ball spun as it headed toward Johnny, clunking toward the ball in his snow boots, buckles clattering. He saw the ball, opened his eyes wide, tucked his tongue into the corner of his mouth. He clenched his hands and extended his arms like a field goal kicker. He drew his leg back and kicked at it just as the ball turned right. Johnny looked up at the pigeon club swooping over the school. He held out his arms like a blue whale pigeon. He cracked the small of his back on the blacktop as Sister whipped around and slapped hands with her psychopath first base girl. Ribbons of color shot across Johnny's eyes. He caught his breath and realized where he was. And Johnny sat back on his hands looking out at Sister. "Missed it by a mile," someone said. Johnny wanted to play for the Yankees, and here he was sitting on his butt on the playground with Sister Marge chewing confiscated fruit stripe gum, maybe his gum, glaring at him, just a dumb little kid. While he sat there, Johnny locked eyes with the third baseman, the fourth grade boy who had given him the 14 cents to find his Mickey Mantle card, that there was no way he would find that card. "Get up," the boy yells at Johnny. With her head down, Sister towed the pitcher's rubber green chalk mark on the blacktop. With one hand, she caught the ball fired back to her from the catcher on Johnny's team. Johnny heard giggling. "Come on, let's go, let's go. We want a bat, too." Johnny rolled over to push off the stand. He returned to place his heels against the white garage door. "Johnny Moon, come on, Johnny, hit it out of here," someone said. Sister coiled into her stance and began her approach. Johnny shuffled fast toward the ball in his big buckle overshoes. The ball took a screwball turn. Johnny sat on his hands in a haze. The third time, Sister deigned to make great giant slow motion gestures, showing she wasn't doing anything strange with the ball. Johnny took a giant lunge kick and popped out weakly to the second sacker wearing a blue plaid skirt, black shoes, white blouse, and red button-down sweater. "Moonshot! That!" Johnny sat down on the blacktop against the garage. He stretched out his legs with his giant snowshoes pointing straight up. Put up his left hand in front of him like a partial parenthesis and placed the middle finger of his other hand just inside the parenthesis to show the second base person. "Sister! Johnny Moon!" Mr. Mary Michael's fingers in the mouth whistle signaled the end of noon recess. She waved her hand twice, 180 degrees, to tell Sister Mark to stop pitching and help her gather the children to go inside. Sister Mark pounded the ball with both hands on the pavement and pointed to the next girl in line. You're next! To say that girl was the first batter in tomorrow's recess. But it was Friday. By Monday, maybe, the girl could only hope that Sister Mark would forget whose turn it was. Sister Mark pointed at each of the rubber bases and the home plate and then marched off tall and straight, dribbling the kickball as she went toward the fourth grade entrance, followed by her sweaty, jabbering class. In the classroom, after the coats and hats and boots were put away and the last of the outside-type stories told, the third-grade boys and girls found their desks and began to steel themselves for what was to come, a whole afternoon of English, arithmetic, and vocabulary. Sister Mary Michael hit her mark in the center of the room in front of the class, between them and the blackboard. At least she got to see out the windows at the grain elevator and the bank and the radio tower. Sister something, the principal, appeared miraculously in the doorway. Her brown robes gracefully just skimmed the floor. She folded her arms at her waist, each arm presumably tucked into the opposite sleeve where Kleenex and absconded magic markers and matchbox cards were also stored. Sister Mary Michael hustled over like a ball player to a coach. The two whispered. The children fidgeted with feet stretched back, turning around to talk, poking someone in back of them with a pencil and smiling, looking behind with a mirror. Looked like all were silent and serene from a distance, like the earth from the moon. But up close, all were engaged in some sort of activity, surreptitious and not. Johnny messed with his rings. He wished he had enough for all 10 and wondered if Jimmy Purple would take him to the dime store and show him how to cob things. Jimmy said he went down with a winter coat, just messed with something he was like he was looking over to buy, and then just pushed it down into his sleeve. He walked out of there with his sleeves full of cool stuff, pens, gums, markers, and ink pads. Johnny wanted a couple more rings. Sister Mary Michael turned toward the class, her head down, her hands folded together. She slid back to the door when Sister Principal something stuck her head back in and held her arm out with a fistful of Kleenex. For the girl, she whispered, and nodded toward the class. Sister Mary Michael found her spot directly under the clock above the chalkboard. It said 12:40. She looked up to the class. She had red, shiny eyes, and her nose was running. She wiped tears away with her wad of Kleenex. The children tried to figure out what was wrong. Maybe some kid and his family had been killed in a car accident. Maybe this morning's mass didn't count because of Johnny Moon. They were all getting venial sin for missing mass on a weekday. Maybe bowling would not be held next month either. But for sure, Sister was crying in public in class, and they grew nervous, like horses in a barn with a tornado headed their way. Class, girls and boys, she said. She took a deep breath, which they could tell because her robes moved. Class, girls and boys. The president has been shot. Oh! The class sat with eyes and mouths wide open, staring hard at Sister, then to each other. What? What did she say? The president? The president? Sister fell to her knees on the hardwood floor, found her rosary, crossed herself, and began, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, each child slid out of their desk to kneel on the right side. Each folded their hands and bowed their head to just touch the tip of their noses with the tip of their index fingers. like expectant young angels at the feet of God's almighty throne. Jimmy Purple slid off the left side of his desk, putting him right next to a girl he liked and refused to yield. The sister led the class in the sorrowful mysteries of the rosary. She then pulled and pushed herself up by one of the front row desks and stumbled over to her desk. She disappeared behind the statue of St. Michael the Archangel that the other nuns had given her on her last feast day. They heard Dave in the hallway through a crack in the door left by the principal, talking about whether to bring in radios or TVs to the classroom, where they could get them, and whether the cords would reach. "We're all going to die," someone whispered. "There'll be a nuclear war. Nice knowing you. Communists did it. Because of the Beatles and Castro." "Oh, brother. We'll never go to the moon now, so forget that." A girl in the front desk turned and stuck her whole body into the aisle to look at Johnny. "We never were," said someone else. At the same time, the boys and girls realized they would be soon rounded up by Russian soldiers, made to line up in the playground and say there's no God. A boy and a girl shot from their desks and ran to the window to stand on their tiptoes and pull themselves up by the ledge to try to see down into the street and up to the sky. Sister wiped her nose and began to ask them to please return to their seats and then asked if they could see anything. Johnny curled his toes inside his shoes, clenched his hands into kung fu general fists. "We choose to go to the moon," Johnny whispered. "And the other things." He couldn't believe he was doing this. "Not because it is easy, but because it is hard." Johnny pushed himself out of his desk to his knees. The children turned their heads into the aisle to see. Johnny flexed his fat hands, placed them flat on the wood floor. With the back of his hand, he swept away some of the dirt and playground mud. He leaned over his hand and stretched back his legs to stand on his tiptoes. He kicked out his legs and shook them out like a sprinter getting ready for a race, the way Coach Isham had shown him. He checked the back of his pants and gave a yank to make sure he didn't moon everyone like he'd done once during exercise with Coach. He took a deep breath, let himself down. "Johnny Moon can't do a push-up," one of the boys said. Johnny's face glowed reddish red. His hands turned whiter. His arms shook as he brought his nose down to just touch the wooden floor. He exhaled and pushed up. His legs shook. "Not because they're easy, but because they're hard," he said in a rush as he reached the top and held it. Again, Johnny let himself down and pushed himself up, and again, as the other children watched him with their mouths open. Jimmy Purple and Michael Irish plopped to the floor, their joints cracking, and began doing push-ups, their behind high in the air like cows rising. Sister Mary wiped her eyes with the tail of her headdress, pushed off from her desk, walked to the front of the room, and she stared down at the three boys on the floor. She stretched out her arms and dropped to the floor like a cliff diver, smacking her hands on the tile, and began doing push-ups, pausing on one arm to throw her veil out of her eyes. The children flooded the aisle, began kicking each other to have enough room and stepping on each other's hands to have enough room and farting on accident and on purpose in order to have enough room to do push-ups. A few minutes later, they all sat in the aisles breathing hard. Sister Mary Michael sat with her back against the front wall, her legs bent upward, both hands clutching a rosary, staring out the windows at nothing. They heard amplified noise coming from the brown box intercom among the cloakroom. First, they heard messing with papers and a loud thud and a chair scooting and whispering. Then they heard Father's voice and Sister Principal something, as if they were arguing. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. That was Father. Please, silence. That was Sister. And then a couple of frantic whispers back and forth. President John F. Kennedy has died. Let us pray. And the principal began leading them in the rosary. Sister Mary Michael and the children willed themselves again into kneeling position on the floor and followed along on the Hail Marys. And that's the news from Moonrock Lake, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the journalists and Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. And that pretty much wraps up the Thanksgiving edition of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. Hope you'll be back next Thursday and every Thursday right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com to listen to the New American Dream Radio Show. And remember, Revolution Radio is a listener-supported network, and they do deserve your support. So head on over to freedomslips.com and find that donation button. Show them some love. Show them some gratefulness for Thanksgiving. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mike Palachek, who wasn't able to join me tonight, but he did prepare a really good script for me with all the Johnny Moon story. And I really appreciate my great guests, Frank Cordero and Phil Ferrugio, who are on every week, Julius Auerfong, Karen Katowski, and Michael Annis, who join us on the fourth week of every month. Certainly appreciate them. He's 5'4", and he... Hang on one second, I need to pull something up here. It's amazing how much less time there is to handle things when I'm doing this by myself and without Mike. But he's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. Been a soldier for 1,000 years. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the rights. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned them at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. He is the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Will you fight? No! We will run! And we will live!
Shame on you!
This could be the greatest night of our lives. But you're gonna let it be the worst.
And I guarantee a week won't go by in your life you won't regret walking out, letting them get the best of you.
Well, I'm not going home.
We've got too far!
And I'm gonna stay right here and fight for this lost cause.
A day may come when the courage of men fails, but it is not this day.
The line must be drawn here. This far, no farther.
I'm not saying it's gonna be easy.
You're gonna work harder than you ever worked before.
But that's fine, we'll just get tougher with it.
If a person grits his teeth and shows real determination,
failure is not an option.
That's how winning is done.
Believe me when I say,
we can break this army here.
And win just one for the Gipper.
But I say to you, what every warrior has known since the beginning of time,
you've got to get mad.
I mean plumb mad dog mean.
If you would be free men, then you must
fight to fulfill that promise. Let us
cut out their living guts
1 inch at a time.
And they will know what we can do.
Let no man forget how menacing we are. We are lions.
You're like a big bear, man.
This is your time.
Seize the day.
Never surrender.
Victory or death.
That's the Chicago.
Who's with me?
All right,
let's fly!
And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall know my name is the Lord!
But I tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take
our Independence Day!
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. One world coming together to bring freedom home. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We gotta stop them! Kill us all.
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they...